So starting with the topic of philosophical anthropology and me, and might as well say philosophical anthropology and you, I want to step back a second. And we've been engaged in lots of theoretical arguments and debates, and we want to think about what motivates them and how do we situate those in our day-to-day lives. And I want to distinguish with respect to questions about who we are and what we are, three different kinds of questions: existential kinds of questions and ways in which we can ask who we are and what we are, practical questions, and theoretical kinds of ways of asking who we are and what we are. And to what degree are these able to be harmonized and ordered and coordinated, brought together? And to what degree do some generate these other questions? To what degree are theoretical inquiries brought about through our existential and practical kinds of questions? So first off, I should clarify what I mean by each of these. By existential questions, I mean the kind of inquiry that Aristotle and Aquinas suggest that we at times in our lives raise about what are the ultimate ends we pursue. So if you think of the first book of the Nicomachean Ethics, or in Aquinas' Summa Theologia in the Prima Secunda, questions 1 through 5, he asks these questions of, is the ultimate end of life, the governing principle, the purpose of life, riches in this life, success? Is it family? Is it something created? Does it have to be something uncreated? These are more often than not things that we just take for granted as a part of the culture and the tradition we're brought up in. But at times, maybe through crisis, through the loss of a friend or the loss of a life, or maybe we just find ourselves in a philosophical seminar room and asking these questions and taking them seriously. That's the kind of thing I mean by existential questions. Existential worldviews have to do with our fundamental ways in which we think about our life and our death. And actually, it's often not the ways in which we think about it. It's more, in fact, the ways in which we do, in fact, treat life and death, or think about or fail to think about life and death in our lives. It's very important that this is not conceived of as a kind of theoretical inquiry in the way that it is, in fact, a theoretical inquiry in the Nicomachean Ethics or in Aquinas' Summa. If you think more like what Augustine's working through in the Confessions, that's much more what I have in mind, of someone who's confronting obstacles in their life and realizes they need to reevaluate the priorities and the way in which they're governing what they're doing in their lives. But connected to these existential questions, which we often don't ask about ourselves, we often just live lives, and often live lives that are not consistent with the things we say we're living our lives about, we also engage in a range of practical questions. Very simple things of like everyday routines of sleeping and eating and hygiene, treating illnesses, figuring out how to commute, engaging with everyday friends and family, colleagues, but also much more systematic other kinds of complicated practices, the kind of everyday practices of perhaps one's occupation or job, whatever that might mean. So practices of fishing, practices of teaching, practices of grading papers, these sorts of things that have to do with our practical lives, as well as both short-term and long-term goals in which we engage. All these kinds of existential and practical questions of our common sense, plain person's lives, these are relevant to philosophical anthropology. These are the sort of things that John Paul II is drawing our attention to at the beginning of the Fides et Ratio, when he's asking these basic existential questions, and that, in a certain sense, to ask them, even without philosophical training, is to be engaged in a kind of philosophical inquiry, a kind of philosophical inquiry of existential practical significance. What's important to see here is that theoretical inquiries emerge from our existential and practical kinds of inquiries and stances. There might be various aspects of things in our lives. Perhaps we're interested in farming or crops, trying to predict the weather. And these can inspire systematic investigations into meteorology, systematic investigations of a theoretical nature into animal husbandry or crop husbandry. They can also inspire the kind of theoretical inquiries many of you engage in physics and chemistry and biology. These kinds of practical questions not just raise these ethical day-to-day questions, but what is it to be ethical? What is virtue? What is justice? And so these practical questions about justice can give rise to what are the theoretical foundations for justifying and giving a further explanation systematically for the kinds of accounts of justice that I encounter in my day-to-day lives. What's important to see is that philosophical inquiry as a kind of theoretical inquiry and a scientific inquiry as a kind of theoretical inquiry are always types of practices. Even when they're theoretical inquiries, they are practices of theoretical inquiry. Practices that require expensive institutions, that require decades of formation and training, that often require specialization, that you start taking the authority of a curriculum that's given to you, and only later acquire the resources that are required to give justification for the fruitfulness of one form of curriculum over another. And so it's very important to see the way in which these three kinds of inquiries and stances are found in our lives, and what do we do to try to bring them together? In what way can you start off with an existential worry, engage in a philosophical kind of inquiry, start studying philosophy at a university, and then decades later realize that you've only kind of lost yourself in academia and just asking these theoretical seminar philosophy questions, and you've kind of completely forgot about the original existential. You've even maybe let it go by the wayside and have not continued to return back to that question. So I'm going to come back to this idea of how do we keep the harmony of these, but I want to show that these are also interesting, and not just interesting, necessary features of what a philosophical anthropology has to engage in. All of these aspects are drawing attention to the way in which wonder is central to our lives. Not just theoretical wonder, but types of existential and practical wonder. Wonder fundamentally aims at truth, but in order to make claims about the truth, one has to make themselves vulnerable. Truth assertions require vulnerability to being objected to, something you all are encountering insofar as you're engaging arguments, as you should be engaging in arguments throughout this time in the symposium. But to put that forward and to be clear about what it means to say something is truth requires being vulnerable to what it would be required to falsify that. What sort of objections could be raised against that? One, to really know clearly what it is one is saying is true also requires to try to engage in a more detailed or maybe even systematic inquiry into what are the strongest, most radical objections to the view that I'm holding. I'm not putting forward a kind of skepticism. I'm saying, what are the resources that my claims to truth provide for me to respond to the strongest objections, or to draw upon the best insights to even improve my claims to what the truth is? But it can also be the case that our forms of inquiry, existential, due to our worldview, our culture, our practices, or even our theoretical inquiries, these can conceal from us other kinds of objections, other kinds of questions. When you've engaged in a course of study and a course of discipline, you acquire selective reading habits. You try to always improve your selective reading habits, but it's just the case of what it is to specialize that you rule out reading certain things. You don't take it seriously. You rule out certain kinds of questions. And when you rule them out, are you ruling them out for existential reasons, parts of your worldview? Are you doing it for aspects of your practices? Or are you doing it for theoretical reasons? And what are the justifications for doing that? So what we find often are the motivations for them are our rival existential worldviews, aspects of our practices, and theoretical narratives and counter-narratives we've told. Just over the last 2 days, we've heard, or the last day and a half or so, we've heard lots of different narratives about what we should say about Thomist philosophy and contemporary physics. And we articulate these different narratives, and these motivations that we have, existential, practical, and theoretical, have their part to play in them. And the better self-knowledge we can have is to be clear about what are our motivations for them. For those of you who are Catholics, that's going to be part of the reason for why you're interested in being in here. For those of you who are not Catholics, or at least not Christians, what other motivations do you have here? Maybe it's to come and show the Thomists why they're wrong. Maybe it's just because you're actually curious to see if there is any substance to this Thomist stuff, this Thomist philosophy. There's a lot of complicated reasons for why you're here. There's complicated reasons why Thomists keep going back to Aquinas' texts and Aristotle's, even after 700 years, or even after 2,300 years, and want to continue to defend them. So what are these motivations, and do they stand up against the best kinds of objections? What happens, though, often, is it's difficult to harmonize all these factors together, and so we end up with what Alasdair MacIntyre calls, we all end up being self-divided selves. We have different commitments existentially, different commitments politically, practically, different commitments theoretically, and we might not realize the way in which they don't actually converge. They're actually tearing us apart. These are the way in which families fall apart. These are the way in which someone becomes too dedicated to a career. They might espouse something that says that their career is not the ultimate end of their life, but it ends up being the ultimate end of their life in practice, and it tears them apart existentially, practically, and even maybe causes detriments to their theoretical inquiries. Features of an examination of conscience, of prudence, of practical wisdom is meant to be brought in so we can constantly see how we're navigating our lives and whether or not we're bringing these together. All these kind of features that I'm bringing up now might not seem like they have a lot to do with philosophical anthropology and cognitive neuroscience, but this is the sort of day-to-day experience of human beings that we can never forget when we get lost in our theoretical inquiries. These are the sort of basic starting points from which emerge the theoretical inquiries of cognitive neuroscience and philosophical anthropology. And insofar as we don't have more self-divided selves, we need to try to find ways of integrating them, of bringing them into a harmony. To what degree can we actually hold on to all these strings and keep them all together? So I ask the question, why are you here at this symposium on Thomistic philosophy and natural sciences? There's aspects of your commitments and your worldview that may be playing a part. Are there practical reasons? A priest said, while you're studying biology, you know you should really pay attention to Thomist philosophy. Are you because you want to come here and see if there is anything to Thomist philosophy, that it could actually be something that illuminates aspects of the existential dimensions of your life while you're cultivating a theoretical form of inquiry and practices? Or do you have theoretical reasons for being here? It might be a combination of these. But I think it's worth seriously asking these questions, not just in the way that your mom might have asked, what in the world are you doing this weekend? And you started going into great detail and enthusiasm. She goes, no, I didn't want to know all of that. I mean, that's also the kind of reasons we give to these. But you might have had to apply for research grants for going to things like this and had to justify it. You might also have colleagues that are asking, why are you going to something on, what did you call it? Thomistic philosophy? They don't even know what that is. What does this have to do with biochemistry? What does this have to do with quantum field theory? These are kinds of questions that we not just need to have good answers for, ones that can make distinctions between theoretical, practical, and existential motivations for, but we need to out-narrate the narratives that say that this is something that's superfluous or silly or ridiculous. We need to have compelling and truthful narratives that can give an argument for justifying why it is fruitful for us to come and investigate and to have these kinds of symposiums. And again, it's very human to have all these factors. So that's why it's going to be relevant to what we think about when we get into our theories. If we're trying to tell the story in philosophical anthropology of what a human being is, these are all parts of the data of what a human being is that a theory about human nature can never leave out. What's helpful is to try to distinguish ways in which we agree and disagree with each other. One way in which we agree and disagree is at this level of these existential worldviews. And again, this is not theoretical ways of thinking about them, because there are also theoretical ways of thinking about our worldview, but that's to engage in a theoretical inquiry, which I'm saying is distinct from the sort of deep commitments that govern all of our practices and our theoretical inquiries. Existential worldviews would have to do with whether you identify as being a Christian or a Muslim or an atheistic naturalist or a humanist of some kind, but what's important to see is the way in which someone's atheistic naturalism is just as much a part of their cultural milieu, something they've inherited and picked up that they endorse. And that's where they're arguing from when they engage in theoretical inquiries, just as much as a Christian is arguing from aspects of their Christianity when they're engaging in theoretical inquiries. So we can ask questions and problematize them. We can ask existential questions and theoretical questions about them. But it's important to recognize that we're all arguing from someplace, and we're at different places in our life of being more or less articulate at our justifications existentially, practically, and theoretically for these different aspects of ourselves. So there's not just disagreements at existential worldviews between maybe Christians and atheist naturalists. There's also practical disagreements. Practical disagreements that are as obvious as engaging in disagreements with one's siblings, one's friends, one's colleagues, or different kinds of agreements that are largely required for us to live our lives as we do together. But then there's also different kinds of theoretical disagreements. And this is where it can be tricky, because we often presume that we're either, once we engage in a kind of disinterested, standing back, kind of neutral view from nowhere when we engage in theoretical inquiries, that's actually quite deceptive. We don't, in fact, achieve some sort of neutral, universal look upon things. We're always arguing out of our existential worldviews and our practices, arguing out of the education and the curriculum and the traditions that we've received. And when we engage in these agreements and disagreements, we need to find out how much we actually agree upon. So at a first level of theoretical disagreement is more like the kind of disagreements that are going on in this symposium with the counter-narratives and narratives of Thomism that we've been hearing. So that's to agree largely and come from the same theoretical tradition. You can take for granted many of the same moving points and positions. So, for instance, you might have a debate about rival Thomist accounts of age and intellect abstraction, or we might have rival Thomist accounts about evolution and what we should say about that. There's a lot that can be taken for granted within those debates about what we think about being, what we think about truth, what we think about rational justification. We understand some of the same moving pieces of hylomorphism and act potency and the causes. And those things that we can take for granted allow us to get much, much more sophisticated and specialized in these debates. But those debates are very different from a second kind of theoretical disagreement, which occurs from people coming from rival traditions, who don't agree about what being is, who don't agree about what reality is, who don't agree about what rational justification is. So if you were to engage in contemporary debates on free will that come out of analytic philosophy of mind, they presume certain things about causation that Thomists don't accept. They presume certain things about agency and event causation or agent causation that Thomists don't endorse. They assume certain things if they have a theistic context, where they don't make distinctions between primary and secondary causality. And so to bring Thomist accounts of free will into those debates is either going to just distort the Thomist account by forcing Thomas to engage and endorse a view of agent causation he doesn't accept, or you're just going to beg the question against this other view because they don't accept Thomas's view about four causes, about primary and secondary causality, and so forth. So those debates actually have much, much wider, deeper disagreements that we need to be aware of. What these views might have in common is that they think that theoretical and rational inquiry is ordered towards getting at the truth of the matter. But there's another kind of theoretical disagreement, one where you might have where people don't even agree about whether rational inquiry is directed towards truth. They might think that the whole story about rational inquiry is just a mask for one more will to power. And that's going to be a different kind of debate to engage those antagonists with respect to the view that one's coming from. This becomes very important, too, when we start thinking about how to engage different subdisciplines within the sciences and the kind of different rival views that they have, and maybe even different rival philosophical frameworks that have governed the kind of theoretical inquiry these scientific disciplines have been engaged in. To what degree is the truth of the science able to be distinguished from some of the conceptual philosophical views that have motivated them and inspired them, but perhaps are not necessarily connected up with them? The Aristotelian tradition has already done that with respect to itself. Aristotle identifies the basic integrator of our sensory and motor information with the heart, because Aristotle doesn't yet have an anatomy that's distinguishing between blood vessels and the nerves. So when Galen, who's more or less an Aristotelian, comes around in the 3rd century AD, he can deploy this new anatomical knowledge that makes a distinction between the nerves, which are fed up through the spinal cord and going into the ventricles of the brain, versus Aristotle, who had no distinction between the way in which we integrated sensory and motor information and thought it was all located in the heart. So already Aristotelians could radically revise aspects of their empirical doctrine without changing their views about hylomorphism and psychology and the soul. And so then when they start developing a ventricle doctrine of where the localization of sensory powers like memory or imagination are at, which if you read Thomas, imagination's in the front ventricle, memory's in the posterior ventricle. This ventricle doctrine is the dominating view of brain science as it is, up through Leonardo da Vinci, who is one of the people who helped us discover that they aren't just big, huge cavities, but by injecting wax into cows' ventricles of their brain, discovered and illustrated in great detail in the early 16th century what the ventricles actually look like, which is more like a Klingon ship than big, huge holes. But then once you get to people like Descartes and Thomas Willis, they start directing our attention away from the ventricles and what they called was vital pneuma, but we think of as cerebral spinal fluid. They moved us away to that and started looking at the actual tissue of the brain. Descartes famously asked us to look at the pineal gland for the unifying part of the brain. Thomas Willis, who had Christopher Wren as a young man drawing a lot of his illustrations of his dissections of brains, locates this in the corpus callosum. Up until later in the 19th century when we start thinking about the neuron doctrine, and now we've combined the neuron doctrine with aspects of glial systems as well as features of cognitive neuroscience, these modifications are empirical modifications, but we need to ask to what degree can the theory, the philosophical theory of hylomorphism in the soul, continue to be updated or revised in slight ways, but not completely refuted by these various aspects. So next what I want to say is that what we need are truer narratives, better counter-narratives to the narratives that persist in the public light, existential, practical, and theoretical ones, about the incompatibility of religion in these various aspects of science. One thing that needs to be recognized is no single cookie-cutter image or logos or understanding of human beings, whether from common sense, science, philosophy, or theology. One might think it's common sense, what common sense thinks about humans, but actually cultural anthropology will show you there's a wide variety of rival views of common sense. So when scientists and philosophers deploy concepts like common sense, folk psychology, as it's a sort of monolithic, unitary concept, They're deeply distorting and deploying actually a theoretical concept to describe something that's, as some of you maybe know, is very weird. Are any of you familiar with weirdness in scientific research, especially in psychology and social sciences? Weirdness are studies that come from Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic subjects. And not only that, more likely than not, it's because you can get, you know, an Amazon gift card for $20 if you come to this experiment. And so how old are you? You're probably 18 to 22 coming in and doing an experiment. You're about the most least representative population of the entire history of Homo sapiens to be the major subjects for us to discover what neuroscience and psychology have to say about you. These factors are relevant for when we think about the generalization that we're doing. It's not as if these experiments are bad, but they shouldn't be taken to be paradigmatic for human beings in general. So there's not just one view in common sense, but there's also not one view in science. There's not what scientists say about evolution. There's not just what scientists say about human persons or neuroscience. If any of you are working in labs, you know that you might reject what's going on down the hall, just down there, and you are darn sure you're going to show in your next experiment why what they're saying down the hall is false. So within these sub-disciplines, there are both disciplines within the sciences and in philosophy that don't communicate with each other. They're oblivious to ways in which they're doing similar things. But there's also ways in which they do deeply engage in these rival debates. And that's what moves these disciplines forward in their theoretical inquiries, is their ability to lay out hypotheses, to test them, and try to move forward and derive better arguments for justifying the positions they hold. So one thing we need is a much truer narrative of the real plurality of disagreements that we have at lots of different levels in these different areas, and not think and present things as having a completely monolithic, there's only one true account about genetics and its role with respect to human behavior. There's only one account about what human beings are, and they just are their brain, and that's what all scientists or neuroscientists think. It's much more complicated than that. Here we can just consider the varieties of rival and often incompatible scientific research programs, disciplines, and subdisciplines. And this is just a very quick list from the kind of things that I read about, but I know that all of you could generate your own lists. But the differences between experimentalists and modelers. In my lab in Cambridge, the best, most promising experimentalists doing really cool stuff with optogenetics and working on motivation models in rats is now becoming a modeler. And it's sort of like time to have a wake or a funeral for this great experimenter who's leaving this world to go into modeling and abandoning his great competencies. That's a very amusing kind of way in which this happens, but there are actual disagreements between experimentalists and modelers on these sorts of issues. There's also working memory versus cognitive control versus fluid intelligence. These are three areas of discipline in psychology that don't even talk to each other, don't publish in the same journals, but in some respects are working on very similar tasks and are doing very sort of similar things, and these are just their own independent cottage industries, and they have no knowledge really of the existence of each other. There's also disagreements about modest modularity, massive modularity, and neural reuse, which I'm going to come to in a second. You have, which these debates aren't as fierce as they were a few decades ago, between classical computationalism versus connectionism in cognitive science and cognitive neuroscience and cognitive psychology. You also have dual process theories versus those who think that's the most superficial way of carving up the mind possible, even if the philosophers now getting late in the game are trying to copy all the cognitive psychologists who are using it for two decades and then saying they really shouldn't be using it anymore. So you have those debates. And you also have debates about cognitivism versus embodied cognitivism, or the four E's of cognitivism, of enactivism, embodied, extended, embedded is the four. The four E's of cognition, and then radical versions of these, which are views that reject representationalism and reject semantic content and their computational theories. So those are just some of the rival debates that occur in these sort of disciplines. And it's the existence of these diverse rival and incompatible images that makes addressing this earlier question I asked more difficult. How do we transition from our common sense images, the sort of inquiry I was engaged in earlier, how do we transition from that to various theoretical images and logoi, understandings of human persons? And it's important to recognize this distinction between images and logoi. Images and narratives and accounts we tell are indispensable, even to theoretical accounts. When you start telling the story of science, you start telling a story. You tell a narrative to justify aspects of the theoretical inquiry that you engage in. Both are required to sort of move forward these inquiries. But those are going to be different than the logoi itself. That's going to be the articulation of the theory, whether it's in formula, whether it's in arguments, these sorts of things. So what truthful story can the Thomist tradition of inquiry attempt to provide. And to address this is to address an area that makes Thomists, you know, get a little uncomfortable when you start thinking about different types of Thomisms or types of schools. Contentiously enough, I don't think a lot of the divisions of Thomisms as these schools based on figures are very helpful, because I think it's actually really helpful to read all of them and try to appreciate aspects of which they're moving beyond the texts of Thomas, they're getting things right in the texts of Thomas. There's just a lot of really fruitful things that can be learned by reading from all of these schools of Thomas. And presentations of them more often betray one's lack of interest in reading carefully some of these different schools of Thomism. So I'm not making a distinction like that. I'm going to make a distinction more in methods of approach to Thomas. The first kind is not really a kind of Thomism at all, but it's what I call reading and running with it Thomism, which is to pick up something or hear something that someone said, that Aquinas said, and think that that's an interesting idea, and then just go wherever one wants to go with that. That's to generate maybe a kind of eclecticism, but one has to be also self-critical as a Thomist, because that's what we do when often we read other authors and find something interesting in Wittgenstein, find something interesting in Kant, find something in Husserl or Heidegger. And in this context, what are we doing if we're not doing something eclectic when we're starting to look at these areas in sciences? So maybe a quick grab and read of something from Chomsky or dual process theories. Maybe we can think about Thomas's concupiscible and irascible appetites in terms of dual process theories. I mean, I think that would be a wrong way to go, but that would be an example of what a Thomist would be doing when doing a sort of running and reading and running with it, kind of drawing on psychology. The two real powerful versions of Thomism I'm distinguishing as a type of defensive constructive commentary Thomism and a type of Thomist tradition of inquiry. Anything, if you've read of mine from before a year ago, would have classified, I think probably ambiguously, but more or less been classified as a type of defensive constructive commentary Thomism. That's where one sees oneself as the fidelity to certain claims and doctrinal conclusions Aquinas arrived at are something that aren't really up for revision too much. And what you do when you engage something like addiction, as I've done in some of my past articles, is you bring a whole Thomist anthropology to research on addiction. What doesn't change is Thomas's basic divisions of the psychology. But what is up for grabs is trying to draw on aspects of the neuropsychology or some of the clinical literature on addiction and try to apply Thomas to that. This is, I think, more or less the dominant approach of Thomism, and it has been extraordinarily fruitful, and my entire upbringing was brought up doing this kind of Thomism. But I think that it has certain limitations in the ways in which it engages others, and it doesn't get quite to the depths of what Aquinas himself was doing vis-a-vis Augustine and Aristotle and Pseudo-Dionysius and Liber de Causis, of trying to find modes of inquiry that bring you to conclusions that you even sometimes have to revise the modes of inquiry of that you receive from Aristotle and others. So that's my account of Thomism that I'm defending, that I endorse, one that's inspired a lot by Bernard Lonergan and Alcider MacIntyre, of ways of thinking of the Thomist tradition as trying to take seriously in its historical context and for contemporary reasons what it is to be faithful within the Thomist tradition to Thomas's mode of inquiry. In what ways were there limitations to that inquiry? And in what ways do other philosophies and other discoveries in the sciences help us improve and revise aspects of Thomas's inquiry that help us sometimes arrive at the exact same more or less doctrinal conclusions as Aquinas, and sometimes slightly different ones? So an example here would be work that I've done where I presumed Aquinas's four internal senses and then just brought that to contemporary work and perception and just worked through what Aquinas already holds on perception and tried to fit everything I found in perception into that framework, versus another view that might think there are things we need to add to the very mode of inquiry of thinking about perception that might actually require us to revise Aquinas's doctrine of the four internal senses, and we might not have the exact same account. At this point, the inquiry hasn't been done, so no one really knows what the conclusion of that would look like. And that's what it is for an inquiry, to still be moving forward, still taking up objections, still trying to figure and work these things out. So that's the view that I'm going to presume from here. So I'll give some framing of how does a Thomist work through this transition from our common sense images of human persons to theoretical images and logoi of human persons. What arises, at least as a preliminary conclusion so far, is that humans are wondering animals that enact and articulate rival views about who we are and what we are. that's something to be considered and drawn attention to in our philosophical anthropology and our just our general view about what humans are. So let's start with some theoretical heuristics, now transitioning from this sort of common sense image to interesting now raising some theoretical heuristics and distinctions that can help us move forward a type of philosophical anthropology into humans as wondering animals that enact and articulate rival views, existential, practical, theoretical, about who we are and what we are. And then I'm going to move on to what we are by drawing some heuristics and distinctions from Thomas's inquiry, but also from modes of inquiry related to neuroscience. So, who am I? Rival images of different kinds of personal identity. Immediately, when we think about telling the story of your life, how it is that you became the kind of theoretical inquirer you are, how it is you came to the existential and practical stances you have, you're going to get immediately theoretically invested in debates about personal identity. What is it that is the continuity of me? What is it the continuity of us in the social engagements that we engage in day-to-day life? One model that's quite prominent, if not dominant, in philosophical and I think unfortunately in psychological and scientific literature is a rather Neo-Lockean account. So they've just inherited this account from Locke, and philosophers defend these accounts through lots of different kinds of arguments and thought experiments. But it's one that sees our identity in terms of mental identity, just the continuity of our memory or the continuity of consciousness. And insofar as there isn't somebody that's conscious or doesn't yet have memories or doesn't yet have mental competencies, they're not yet a person on this account. And insofar as maybe dementia some other neurodegenerative disorder destroys your memory or destroys your ability to engage in sort of rational or mental activities, you cease to be a person on this account. There are lots of reasons for problematizing this view. We don't have time to go into all the arguments for all these different views, so that's why I'm just laying out these heuristics. And as you saw on the back page, there's a very, very long list of literature of following up on some of these issues. But what Atomus rejects is this view and provides a very different account for how I make sense of the narrative of my life and the continuity of my life. That this is an impoverished, this Lockean account, this mental continuity account, is an impoverished account of the story of human lives I was just telling, the story of all of your lives. It doesn't make sense of what you are and how you actually engage people in your day-to-day lives. It's going to be a non-starter, a problematic way of starting our theoretical inquiry if we try to fit our everyday experience of human beings into this view about what personal identity is. A neo-Aristotelian, Thomist, animalist account of identity thinks of us in terms of an organic continuity from the beginning to the end of a unified life of a developing, dependent, rational animal. And the developing point is really key there because we far too often just have an image of humans as an adult, mature, undisabled, perfectly functional human being. But that's not what we are. Human beings are developmental beings. They have an infancy, they have different stages of life that, because of their dependency on others, they're able to be enabled as linguistic and practical reasoners, to be given baptism, to be brought up and have, you know, confirmation. They're able to engage in education. We have various moments of illness and sickness that affect us at different times in our lives. We have different types of abilities at different stages of our lives. We have different senses of humor at different stages of lives, depending on our friends and our relationships. So there's a continuity of our organic being, of our substance, but it's very much what we are as a developing rational animal, one where our mental states, our consciousness, our ways of our personality change dramatically as we go through adolescence into adulthood. This rational animal's personhood is what grounds the biological and psychological powers that enable the conscious life and the various biopsychosocial cultural developments of the rational animal's personality, including the developments of their collaborative, theoretical, practical, existential inquiries and stances. So a very simple heuristic distinction. It requires a defense between our psychological identity or our personality, something that changes dramatically throughout our lives, something that can be lost in neurodegenerative disorders, but it nevertheless doesn't deprive us of our fundamental ontological identity, of our personhood. Okay? Keeping these two distinctions in mind and not getting confused by using personal a slightly different way now, we can deepen these distinctions further about our personal identity, about who I am, by slowly starting now to move into the question of what are we? What am I? We have what we can distinguish as personal level attributes from subpersonal level attributes. Personal level attributes are things that you would attribute to persons as a whole. Things like conscious awareness, perception, emotion, memory, imagination, inquiry, insight, practical reasoning, types of intentional action, various beliefs and desires. These are distinct from, but often bound up deeply with, a whole host of subpersonal level attributes, features of our nervous system, our cardiovascular system, endocrine systems. If your thalamus goes out of whack, you're going to have lots of psychological, personal level changes and transformations. These are deeply bound up with each other in very important ways. But they're important to be distinct, kept distinct. One thing to draw attention to is these distinctions aren't a panacea. We're still going to have to deal with lots of other theoretical arguments for them, as well as further distinctions, ones that we're about to get to when we talk about more in detail neuroscience and hylomorphism in a bit. But one thing I want to draw attention to is it's not equivalent to a mental-physical dichotomy. I want to sift through this personal-subpersonal distinction, which is pretty popular actually in the literature. Dennett is someone that's sometimes attributed with this, that he made this distinction in Content and Consciousness, which was, I think, 1969. And Dennett later introduced the intentional stance, which, with John McDowell and Jennifer Hornsby, I agree, he's sort of undermined the distinction because he no longer has a real clear criteria to distinguish between personal and subpersonal. But anyway, this is a really well-known distinction in the literature, both in cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience. But I'm not thinking of it in terms of a mental-physical dichotomy. I think we should redeploy it and reconceptualize it, drawing on the resources of hylomorphism. Before doing that, I want to say a few more things. One question is, how do we coordinate the personal level attributes with neural and other biological subpersonal level attributes? Here we enter immediately into a range of debates. One of them is a scientific debate, a debate about localism versus holism versus reuse in neuroscience. So if you look up, I think 2014 monograph on the back, you'll see of After Phrenology by Michael Anderson. And Anderson is interrogating a debate and trying to put forward a new view about how we coordinate personal level with the neural subpersonal level, or even how we coordinate cognitive aspects or modules or cognitive processes with neural features. And this is drawing a lot of meta-imaging data and work like that, and a lot of work in connectionism and work on connectomes. And there's a debate between whether or not we should think of is something like semantic memory. Is this something that is only localized really, really strongly in one area of the brain? Maybe something like something in the medial temporal lobe. Is it just strongly localized there? Or is it just an evolutionary fact of history or contingency that semantic memory seems to somehow require parts of the medial temporal lobe, but in fact history could have been different? Maybe even the occipital lobe in the back of the brain is where semantic memory would have been processed. So any area of the brain can do anything. It's just the architecture and the neighborhoods have been divided up evolutionarily as a just sort of contingency. The third view that Anderson defends is a type of reuse, which is saying that different nodes can do different things in different contexts, and we shouldn't be having an overly localized view. Now, historically, Aquinas is a strong localizationist. He's locating these internal sense powers, memory and imagination, very localized in one ventricle of the brain, or subdividing them for some of the powers. But this is an open debate. Maybe these nodes are deeply interconnected in lots of complicated ways, and there's not a sort of strong localization. That's going to be an empirical question to figure out, and I think Thomas have to just basically be agnostic about that and wait for the empirical data to come in. Sorry, that's just another version of them. But there's also this ontological way of seeing a difference between them that I want to turn to now about hylomorphism versus this mental-physical dichotomy, which is both presumed by monists. So physicalist monists, people that are eliminating materialists, reductive materialists, or non-reductive physicalists, as well as all sorts of dualists, whether they be property dualists, emergentists, epiphenomenalists, or substance dualists. They're all going to presume this mental-physical dichotomy as the way of thinking through the personal and subpersonal. But I want to oppose that and draw attention to a hylomorphic way of thinking about it. The hylomorphic way draws on an analogy Aristotle himself makes when he's trying to clarify to us what the soul is. Aristotle in the Danaeus says that the soul is the form of the body and kind of the way that the power of vision is the form of the eye. So I want to take that and generalize that across all of our embodied psychosomatic powers and thinking of vision isn't just going to be the form of the eye. It's going to be the form, so to speak, of the whole visual system and the way in which it coordinates with memory, which memory may or may not be the form of either the neural reus connectum that's important for memory, or maybe just the medial temporal lobe, depending on how that debate goes. So sifting now into this and developing a little bit more this hylomorphic account, let's get into issues about ontological and neuroscientific descriptions and explanations of human beings. So we're going kind of deeper levels of analysis. We're getting away from our kind of day-to-day experience and trying to figure out what's under the hood. We're going beyond just the things we can experience to the sort of theoretical inferences and accounts of trying to explain what it is that we are as human beings in our day-to-day experiences. One thing that's important to draw attention to, this has already come up in the distinction in primary and secondary causality, or the difference between what a creator does qua creator versus what creatures do qua creatures, is that Thomism endorses a form of descriptive, explanatory, and causal integrative pluralism. What does that mean? There are a variety of true descriptions, not just one. There can be a variety of true explanations coming from lots of different levels. There are a variety of different kinds of causes that are all genuinely contributory and are not in competition. And what we aim for is not just a pluralism, but an integration of these range of true descriptions that can occur at the level of what is the person doing as an intentional agent, what is the person's occipital lobe doing, what is the person's endocrine system doing, what's going on at the level of the chemistry that makes up this person, what's going on at the level of particle physics with this person. Those are a range of true descriptions and explanations that can be provided, and they aren't in conflict or in competition for a single causal role, a single explanatory role. Rather, there's a plurality, and the aim is to try to provide an integrated account of them. So turning now to types of scientific inquiry and the ways in which it can be integrated with some of these philosophical accounts, as well as different levels of philosophical scientific investigation can be integrated together. One thing, again, to draw attention to is that when we engage in these inquiries, is we have a lot of extra scientific and extra philosophical commitments and worldviews that influence our theoretical inquiries. We're all arguing from somewhere when we are arguing to somewhere. So is the from our existential worldview practices or theories? When neuroscientists start investigating certain aspects of memory, maybe in the medial temporal lobe, when they're investigating aspects of vision in the occipital lobe, when maybe they're interested in the visual ventral stream or they're interested in the visual dorsal stream, what they're bringing to their inquiries are a set of just ordinary concepts as well as very theoretically distinguished concepts about memory, cognition, representations, and Libet's experiments on free will from the 80s up through the 90s. Libet has an account of free will that he's deploying and operationalizing in his concept, in his experiments. What we need to ask is, where do those concepts come from? Where does Libet's concept of free will or an intention or urge come from? Where does Larry Squire's accounts of memory come from when he starts subdividing his different long-term memory systems, procedural memory systems? Have these been adequately ethnologically compared to the way in which we actually use memory? Or is it a completely theoretical concept? How many of you know Joe Ledoux and know any of his work on fear conditioning and threats with the amygdala? I mean, Ledoux has worked on fear for almost 30 years, and people now make all sorts of generalizations from his work about the amygdala, but Ledoux has come out recently in the last 3 years of saying, I've been calling this fear, but fear is like an emotion that you're consciously aware of, and all of my research program was never meant to be about conscious fear, and everyone thinks that was what we've been talking about, and I was just kind of sloppily choosing a common sense term to describe a totally non-conscious, non-aware threat system. And now 20 years of research has been influenced by me. And so people will say, like, whales have way more emotions than humans because they have an amygdala that's disproportionately large compared to humans. But all of this research is based upon Ledoux making kind of sloppy distinctions about the ways in which he's talking about fear as opposed to these others. So where do these concepts come from, and how would he have made better concepts that were more useful from the front end of that kind of theoretical inquiry he engaged in? The findings of neuroscience depend upon rigorous experiments, of course, but these rigorous scientific experiments depend also upon, in the best form, of rigorous conceptual frameworks whose definitions are operationalized in their design, implementation, interpretation of the results of these scientific experiments. The concepts you use, especially ordinary kinds of concepts, are not the same as those theoretical concepts, and then when this gets distributed, popularized, when, as you smack your head, and some journalists, you're happy for the promotion, but they've completely misrepresented what your study was saying. These are the kind of things to be have your eye on for thinking about the way in which theoretical inquiries influence common sense, sometimes in deleterious ways. So what concepts of mind, consciousness, psychological phenomena, language, or the soul are operationalized in neuroscientific experiments? The point I'm driving at is that rigorous conceptual frameworks are really required for doing good and operationalizing adequately rigorous scientific experimental design, implementation, interpretation, and application. And that's going to often engage disputes in philosophy. Libet has an account of free will that he operationalizes in his experiments that no Anscombian, Wittgensteinian, or Thomas would accept that account of free will. So what Libet has deployed in his experiments have frankly nothing to do with the kind of intentional action that a Thomas has done. So rather than doing an experiment on free will, he's done an experiment on one concept of free will operationalized in humans that other philosophers just don't even endorse that as a concept of free will. What philosophers do is we specialize in theoretical inquiries concerning conceptual frameworks, amongst other things, but we often completely lack any training in experimental operationalization. We don't know how labs run. We don't know how expensive it is. We don't know how desperate you are for funding. If you work in animal research, we don't know about all the new laws and regulations you're always trying to keep abreast with. We don't know how sociologically your labs are so much different than the thought experiments we engage in our philosophy seminar rooms over coffee, or if no one's looking, some sparkly beverages and things like that. So there's just a different sociology and a different kind of formation, and that informs the way they ask the questions they do. But likewise, scientists, I think, need to recognize that they specialize in operationalizing concepts and experiments, often concepts that you just inherit in your curriculum as you're coming up through your formation and education, and you don't have the position to even interrogate them, let alone the formation and training of knowing how to conceptually interrogate them. You've got to publish, you've got to get on the grant, you've got to do your experiments, you've got to move forward, and that's no fault of your own. That's just how the institutions are functioning and set up. So it's important to be aware of them, that you haven't received any training or very little training. I mean, those of you who are theorists, it's going to be a little bit different. But you've received very little training in critical evaluation of conceptual frameworks. And the importance of this point is drawing attention to the exigency for there to be genuine interdisciplinary collaboration, where our weaknesses and our strengths can be brought together to try to have more adequate, more rigorous experiments and concepts that we employ in our experiments. So whose ontology, which philosophy of neuroscience? To get to the neuroscience, in a certain sense, there has to be an appropriate mediation of a philosophy of neuroscience. And those of you that are scientists, you're not encouraged probably to do this, those of you in grad school, but you should really find your hands on some excellent philosophy of philosophy of science of your various disciplines. And so those of you, sorry, people in physics and chemistry, I don't work on that, but on the back there is some work by Lindley Darden and Carl Craver on philosophy of neuroscience. Darden has also written a book on genetics. And Bechtel, even though I don't have it listed there, Bechtel has written some really good work on biochemistry and cells. This work is really, really fruitful and very different from your textbooks. And these people who know the history of your discipline, they know the rival views that you aren't even taught and the scripts and narratives you receive in your undergraduate lectures. And it's just really helpful for having a much bigger picture than what you're able to probably get in just your lab and the sort of forced specialization that you get early on in your academic career. What needs to be mediated here and distinguished are, again, different approaches theoretically. So hylomorphism is an ontology of inanimate and animate physical things. What we're going to be looking at a little bit is a philosophy of neuroscience, but not just that, it's a philosophy of biology, really, is the new mechanist philosophy. If you aren't familiar with this, hylomorphism is very much a minority view, but because Aristotelianism is getting some popularity in metaphysics, hylomorphism is people are at least talking about it sometimes silently in corners when other people aren't around knowing about it. But the new mechanist philosophy, this is like one of the dominant, if not the dominant view in the special sciences and in the philosophy of the special sciences. So this is not an obscure view. This is a major research paradigm that's going on in North America, in the UK, and in continental Europe. And it focuses in particular on biology, neuroscience, psychology, and cognitive science is what they tend to focus on. And that's kind of an important mediating place with respect to the ontology and then the, in fact, scientific inquiries that many of you are engaging in. So that's how I would situate some of the ways in which you can see connections and ways of building interconnections of how do you get more rigorous concepts? How do you understand the narrative of your discipline? Why it's where it's at? Why are you in this particular paradigm of episodic memory as opposed to someone else who's working on autobiographical memory? And what's the relevance and difference there? Does it make sense to do episodic autobiographical memory in rats? Does it not? These kinds of questions, these people are good at asking them and sort of interrogating and raising good questions about these programs. So let's turn to hylomorphism, which we've heard quite a bit about already. Thomistically modified quotes from Jaworski, who's a non-Aristotelian hylomorphist. But I think it's helpful to find other ways of articulating hylomorphism other than the ways that we find in the kind of Thomist writing I and other people in this room do, to find other ways of articulating them as well. So I'm just going to read the main lines because you have the detailed parts on your handout. But the view here is that that organization and form is real. We're not just making concepts up, we're just not just nominalists, that we discover in our empirical disciplines different kinds of organization that make a difference to the components that are organized. So substantial formal organization, it matters. Substantial formal organization makes a difference. If it wasn't there, the components would behave differently. And it also counts. It provides ways of actually individuating and finding the unity of various items and entities or mechanisms that you want to pay attention to. Now, what we have only kind of grazed upon is that there are a lot of rival versions of hylomorphism. A non-Aristotelian hylomorphist is a kind of minimal transformationist. They think forms are real, that they unite and maybe actualize powers of organized components, but they don't make those components into what they are. They don't make components have the kind of nature that they have. Those components probably have the character they have independently from the form. So the components have an identity independent from their unifying form. An Aristotelian hylomorphist holds the thesis of substantive transformationism. Forms not only unite, actualize, but they also transform and make the components to be what they are. Components derive their identity from their unifying form. So this is going to be an inner debate between hylomorphists, which we're not going to resolve here, but, you know, you should have those debates. Those are important debates to have. So within hylomorphism, we can begin to think about souls, but it's important to distinguish different rival concepts of souls. And we need to know even why we want to talk about souls. We shouldn't start conversations with souls unless we already know we agree about what we're talking about with souls. If we can't get from the common sense, ordinary, rival ways in which we talk about ourselves to souls, we don't have a deep handle on how we're using the concept of soul in our day-to-day conversations or our theoretical debates and disagreements. For Aristotelian, a soul is an explanatory factor, but we need to know what it explains. And again, the starting point is the unity of the lives of human persons. Souls and brains both provide sort of background explanations of human persons, but in different ways. And it's important then to recognize that there are rival conceptions, theoretical conceptions of souls and what they explain. Very, very briefly, we can distinguish between Cartesian mind's views of souls and Aristotelian animating form's views of souls. So Cartesian minds start often with a mental-physical dichotomy, identifying the mind or the soul with the mental. And they often think about it in terms of either two substances, or if they're not a substance dualist, they might be a property dualist. And they're going to distinguish between mental substances and physical substances, or mental properties and physical properties. On this account, I am my mind. I can be united to a body that's other than me, but what I am fundamentally is a mind. This is a very different kind of view about souls than the more biological, then psychological kind of souls that you find in Aristotle. Souls as animating forms. Here, as we've heard already, so I'm going to go very quickly through this, hylomorphism is doctrine of matter and form. It's an account of one substance constituted from the unity of organic matter that's animated by an actualizing form. The animating forms can be vegetative, sentient, or rational souls, and it has a very transformative account of this, the ways in which these forms transform some aspects of the components. If you're Aristotelian, they do so substantively. If you're non-Aristotelian hylomorphist, they do so minimally. On this account, I'm not my mind, I'm not my soul, and I'm not my brain. I'm a rational animal. I'm a living organism. Furthermore, they have a very different view, and this is how they start applying these aspects to common sense or plain persons. They have very different views about my mental life and thinking of mental life and linguistic thinking as fundamentally private, first and foremost, and that it somehow extrinsically causes my body to move and causes this extrinsic bodily public behavior. So on this account, bodily behavior is observable, but other minds are unobservable, and they're only known by inference. Maybe they're known by theory of mind, by mind reading. So the whole massive work in comparative psychology, the work on autism, the work in developmental psychology that talks about theory of mind and mind reading, it's presupposing this conceptual framework of a kind of Cartesian mind. It might be a completely physicalist view, but the way the concepts function and move, it's a completely Cartesian view. And all of this research since Premack's 1978 paper on does a chimpanzee have a theory of mind is presuming this psychological framework. So if Aristotelian or Thomas wants to engage in that debate, the first thing to do is not engage the empirical literature about whether or not chimpanzees can pass the false belief test, why autistic children can't pass false belief tests. It's the first to interrogate the conceptual structure of what it is to even know other minds, and that's to have a very different account. On this account, animal behaviors are largely psychological behaviors, and psychological phenomena are largely observable embodied psychological behaviors. So our psychology is something you actually observe in the embodied behaviors of the animals around you. That said, there are features of us that have unobservable psychological phenomena. I don't know how many of you are in fact paying attention or have just got a really good poker face. I don't know how many of you are finding this agreeable or disagreeable, although even when we think things, we have integrated with that definite and indefinite forms of bodily behavior that are attached to our sort of unobservable conscious thoughts. I can see grimaces when someone says, that's not what Thomas thinks. I can just see that in your face, and you can see that in mine. And it's a part of what the face is as expressive, not distinct as hiding some intrinsic emotion, but that is part of what the criteria of the expressions of certain psychological features of us are. What we need to then do is often focus more, and this is where neuroscience and Thomism are going to come into deeper connection. It's not in this area about substances. That's going to be a much more of an ontological story. It's going to be in the way in which our psychological attributes, the ones grounded in our substance, these, as Lonergan calls them, conjugate forms, or more traditionally, accidental forms, these are really where we want to focus our attention for seeing ways in which neuroscience and Thomism can have something to say to each other. So here again, we can repeat these earlier points that I made, drawing on Jaworski, about conjugate forms or accidental forms, that they matter, they make a difference, that they count, but also they psychologize. So sensations, perceptions, affectivity, understanding, rational reflection, these are all different types of organized activities of psychological powers. How does this picture differ from standard views of emergentism or views of dualisms or various kinds? On those accounts, the neural organization produces or generates some distinct extrinsic mind or mental properties. Causation here, then, on that emergentist view, a view that's in competition or a rival view to hylomorphism, it thinks of causation then as two-way, that there's a physical brain, it generates and introduces new information for the mind, and then the mental properties of the mind then in turn cause changes to the physical properties of the brain and the body. On this account, the mental and the mind or cognitive properties are at the personal level, and it's the brain or the body that are part of the subpersonal level. But this is not the kind of picture that a hylomorphic animalist, a Thomist, would hold. Again, this is another cartoon. I'm just running through the view quickly. Here, animals are the fundamental entities. Animals are unified psychosomatic wholes. They're not only one, more than the sum of their parts. The actualization, identity, and subsistent conditions of an animal's material parts, those are determined and depend upon its substantial form. And it defends a version of organizational realism both about the substance and about the conjugate or accidental form of matter. It's the substance of the animal that grounds its powers and its operations. So here we have a very different view, coming back now to this personal, subpersonal level. On this account, the psychosomatic, the embodied powers of like memory, imagination, executive function, executive control, these kinds of things, these are all embodied powers as distinct from noetic or immaterial intellectual powers. And they're all grounded in the soul, but these are personal level attributes of the animal. What's the subpersonal level are the organized material components of these embodied psychosomatic powers. And it's neuroscience, amongst other biological sciences, that provides descriptions and explanations of these subpersonal level attributes of human persons. So what are these subpersonal organized material components of the animal's psychosomatic powers? And for this, we have to turn to the new mechanist philosophy of neuroscience. So briefly, the new mechanist approach has a very, very different account of mechanisms than what you're probably familiar with. They write that in many fields of science, what's taken to be a satisfactory explanation requires providing a description of a mechanism. So it's not surprising that much of the practice of science can be understood in terms of the discovery and description of mechanisms. So what are these mechanisms for new mechanists? They're not machines. They're not deterministic. They're not reductionist. They're not always localizable. And they're not fictions or metaphors or explanatory heuristics, for they describe and explain ontic structures in the world. So what are they? And here I'm just going to focus on the last one from Karl Kraver's book, Explanations in the Brain. Mechanisms are entities and activities that are organized such that they exhibit the explanandum phenomenon. So they identify for us four features that are common to these mechanisms. Phenomenon that's produced by a mechanism or underlies a mechanism or that generates a phenomenon. The component entities of the mechanism, the various activities of the components, and their organization. This point about organization is key because they're ontic or organizational realists, just like hylomorphists. And they're focusing more on the empirical data. The hylomorphists want to talk at a more ontological level. So a typical example that Karl Kraver will put out is this activity of some sort of sign, some sort of psychological activity. And that psychological activity may be, you know, having an episodic memory. That itself is constituted from a range of components, maybe neural assemblies in the medial temporal lobe, maybe in the hippocampus. These neural assemblies are component entities that have various types of neurotransmitters, various types of spike trains that are going on. These component entities all have to be organized in a certain way to constitute the phenomena of episodic memory. What episodic memory does is not the same thing as what these components do, but the components acting in an organized fashion that they do is required in order for the animal to engage in a type of episodic memory. I'm not going to read all that. So these component entities have properties like location, size, structure, duration, orientation. They could be enzymes, neurotransmitters, neurons, organs, organisms. These are all entities that engage in these activities. And then the activities are themselves things that have spatial temporal location, rate, duration, types of reciprocal entities and properties required for such activities. But what's important here is to draw attention again is active organization, the way that this is important to these biological systems. It distinguishes mechanisms from mere aggregates or heaps of matter, such as piles of sand. These parts act and interact with one another in such a way that the whole is literally not a mere sum of its parts. Mechanisms are in this sense non-aggregative. The sum of the mechanisms are organized in ways that go beyond, for example, the contribution made by the massive grain of a sand to the mass of the pile. So mechanisms are not mere sums of their parts, of their component parts. The last quote here, Kraver shows and argues that mechanisms, by virtue of their organization, are able to do things that parts cannot do. This is a key thesis that hylomorphists also argue for in the ontological realm, and here it's coming up in the philosophy of neuroscience. So they can respond to inputs and parts that the parts alone cannot detect, and they can produce behaviors that their parts alone cannot produce. There are generalizations about causal relevance that are true of mechanisms as a whole, but they're false about their parts. What's further interesting here about the new mechanisms is the way in which these mechanisms are components themselves, mechanisms that are themselves components that are mechanisms that are organized. And so it can go from a psychological phenomenon into looking at neurophysiological features, into looking at maybe proteins and ion channels and the gates that are opening and closing at synapses. And you can keep getting down and down to the genetic level even further at looking at the kind of levels of mechanisms that occur. So here's an example of using O'Keefe's work on navigating Morris water mazes, of the way in which the mouse level of its mechanistic explanation, then looking at the way the hippocampus would function in this, looking at the neurons inducing long-term potentiation, and looking at NMDA receptor activations. So anyway, that was a run-through. If you want to know more details about this, I've written about the comparison of the disagreements and agreements of new mechanism and hylomorphism in the paper that's on the back, that's also in the volume that William Simpson edited that people have been mentioning, that Bill Carroll drew attention to is very expensive, but a free copy of the paper is on my academia page, or you can just email me and I'd send it to you. So coming back now, I'll bring this to a conclusion. Hylomorphic animalism, I'm suggesting, provides an ontology of the conjugate psychosomatic powers and operations of animals. But we can fill those out. We can find out what's under the hood empirically that explains these by drawing upon aspects of the new mechanist philosophy of biology and neuroscience and psychology to provide a rich philosophical interpretation of the hierarchies of mechanisms nested within other mechanisms. we make all these distinctions in order to unite, and this is a point that Maritain often makes for us. So we've ran through a whole range of distinctions, but the real task of Thomist philosophical anthropology and a type of interdisciplinary integration is to move these inquiries forward, to have these collaborations, to continue to have these workshops and conferences, and try to figure out how can we bring together our theoretical inquiries, in what way is our faith informed by them, in what way is our faith further defended by them, in what ways does it provide challenges to other sort of existential worldviews, in what ways can it shape and improve our practices and our day-to-day lives. And so what in addition to all these inquiries, we also need to be able to articulate something like what is the truest narrative we can tell so far of how we articulate and expand the perfect, how we expand and perfect the truth of these old Thomist insights and truths, but we can expand and perfect them by way of thinking about what's the most truthful image of us as human beings. And thank you.
So you mentioned that Bourdieu has a different notion of free will that's incompatible with...
Libet does, yeah.
Libet, yeah. So how is it different, I guess?
Yeah, so that takes quite a bit to explain. One thing I would look at is look at Peter Hacker's work in Philosophical Foundations of Neuroscience in the chapter on free will where he looks at the Libet account. Hacker's Wittgensteinian account of agency and involuntary action is pretty similar to what an Aristotelian one would be. I think Stephen Brock provides one of the best treatments of Aquinas on action, and you're going to see a lot of similarities between Brock's account of action and Peter Hacker's Wittgensteinian Aristotelian account. Part of it is I just think that it's mythical to say before we engage in voluntary actions, like you asking the question you asked and me now giving the answer I'm giving, that I stopped and waited for an impression of a voluntary agency, and that gave me the green light to give the kind of voluntary action. And Anscombian thinks that part of the intention is embodied in the action I'm doing. I don't have to stop and form the proposition of what I'm going to do intentionally and then give the green light and go. A voluntary action is a deeply embodied one where the intention is what's structuring and organizing the embodied behavior I'm giving in involuntarily. And how do you discriminate between voluntary and non-voluntary actions or intentional, non-intentional? Anscombe's intention is this long account of the appropriate kind of why question of why did you do that? And the appropriate kind of answer that you could give that really, truly, and genuinely is an account for what you did when you just did this voluntary action, that's what's going to be required. But Libet's whole experiment requires that they sit back, watch the Libet clock, and wait for an intention, wait for a choice to emerge from their conscious state and then act on it. And I just think that's a mythical account of what a voluntary action is. It's more like, as Hacker shows, it's more like an inhibited sneeze theory of free will. It's more like I become aware of my urge to sneeze, and then I try to stop it or I let it go through. And that's really what Libet's account of free, and there's no free will, but there is free won't, that we can inhibit or veto them. So I think that just looking at how we should think about an adequate account of voluntary agency just shows those concepts you deployed by Libet are deeply problematic in his experiments.
I was wondering about your suggestion that there's more, I think you said interdisciplinary communication. Because I like what you said, that scientists need to have more rigorous conceptual frameworks, but that suggestion seems kind of, maybe I'm just pessimistic, but like,
pie in the sky?
Yeah, I think so, sorry, I think so. Also because for practical considerations, some of these, you know, conceptual frameworks in science are really built up, maybe incorrectly, but they have a lot of literature behind them. People have invested a lot of time, and a lot of their research is dependent on them. So do you have more detail?
Well, nothing's going to happen unless the curriculums change. So that's going to have to change, and that's also a very pie-in-the-sky idea that would change in a substantive way. But I think that courses in philosophy of science would be hugely beneficial. People start telling these scripts. So there's a lot of addiction work that's done in Cambridge, and the heads of the faculty until recently, because they're moving on to other faculties, but they've been working on the role of mesolimbic dopamine in a lot of addictions. And their account is to try to push back that mesolimbic dopamine is not necessarily a reward system, but more of a motivation system. And there's also a group in Michigan that's been doing similar research. But yet you'll go to a second year neurobiology or experimental psychology lecture at Cambridge, people who've been in the department for years, and they still tell this old story that mesolimbic dopamine is all about reward, and there's no mention that people down the hall are saying anything about that, about motivation. So this is just sort of the characteristic incompatibilities and incoherences that happen, that they're teaching these students who now might go off and have research in memory, or they might have research in vision, or they might have research in circadian rhythms, and will never have anything to do with addiction again. But when they talk about addiction in their lectures that they give to undergrads future years, it might still be that same old script that's now 30 years out of date. And this is a problem within all of our disciplines due to over-specialization. So pragmatically, it's an enormous problem. So pragmatically, it's difficult to overcome it, but science just does go through major paradigm changes where we realize the conceptual framework we used was inadequate and we need an alternative one. So I just think it takes more people like Ledoux and others coming out and saying, you know, the conceptual framework we used was inadequate and it's been actually largely misleading and we need to be better about that. And so until more big names want to try to restructure the curriculum, there probably won't be a lot that happens. But it does need to happen.
Join me in thanking Dr. DeHaan for...